or Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَإِذْ قَالَ إِبْرَاهِيمُ رَبِّ أَرِنِي كَيْفَ تُحْيِي الْمَوْتَى قَالَ أَوَلَمْ تُؤْمِنْ قَالَ بَلَى وَلَكِنْ لِيَطْمَئِنَّ قَلْبِي قال فخذ أربعة من الطير فصرهن إليك ثم اجعل على كل جبل منهن جزءا ثم ادعهن يأتينك سعيا واعلم أن الله عزيز حكيم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, and when Abraham said, My Lord, show me how you revive the dead. He said, Do you not believe? He said, Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest. He said, Take four of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening, and know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise. Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, they shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by affront, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, FM, and satellites. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5. And Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395 6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
This one lay. Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Now, welcome, everyone. Now, between the turn of the century up until 2015, a number of countries concerned about Iran weaponizing its civilian nuclear program undertook the task of offering the Islamic Republic sanctions relief for curbs to its nuclear program, a process of painstaking diplomacy ultimately culminating in UN Resolution 2231 and the deal that the world came to know as the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. And now parties involved, Russia, China, the U.S., U.K., France, and Germany, were referred to as the P5 plus one, at least up until May of 2018, when then U.S. President Donald Trump decided to unilaterally have Washington opt out of that accord. What came next was the Europeans' outrage. Why? We had unprecedented oversight in Iran, inspectors, inspections, cameras everywhere, access, and Iran was fully cooperating and abiding by its commitments. In fact, the UK, France, and Germany vowed to find ways to keep the deal alive and make sure that Iran receives promised concessions under the agreement. Well, that never came, and Iran, over a year later, finally started rolling back on its JCPOA commitments, which brings us full circle now to this day. Today, a Board of Governors meeting at the International Atomic Energy Agency, the same European Troika, with the help from the US, Israel, and the IAEA head, Rafael Grossi, have decided to activate what's called a snapback mechanism, which refers to snapping back sanctions against Tehran if the country is found non-compliant. So why this move, why now, and how so justified, and Iran's response are points we'll be discussing in today's Spotlight program. But first, here's a report.
Following Thursday's IAEA resolution, Iran's Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran jointly condemned the resolution as politically motivated and biased. They emphasized that Iran has adhered to its obligations, as corroborated by multiple IAEA reports. Tehran says the resolution is inconsistent with the findings of the IAEA Director General's own report. Iran has accused the four sponsoring nations, the United States, the United Kingdom, France, and Germany, of reviving allegations that had already been addressed some 25 years ago as part of its response. Tehran has revealed intentions to enhance its enrichment capabilities by launching a new uranium enrichment facility in a secure site and upgrading the current centrifuges.
The installation that would enrich uranium, we are also trying to replace the centrifuges. The capacity is 9 times bigger than what we had before.
Meanwhile, Iran has published parts of classified Israeli documents that it has recently acquired. These documents confirm that IAEA Director General Rafael Grossi has recently collaborated with the Israeli regime to undermine Iran's nuclear interests. Emails concerning Mirav Zafari Odiz, the former ambassador of Israel to the IAEA, indicate a strong partnership with Grossi. These emails contain a request for a meeting regarding an Iranian missile test.
This is the Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
And now for our guests for our program, we have Batul Sobeti, activist and political analyst, joining us from London. And also in studio, we have Gisu Misha Ahmadi, our senior colleague here and correspondent at Press TV. Hello to the both of you. Pleasure to have you both on. Gisu, we'll start with you. As we embark now on the sixth round of indirect talks, nuclear-related and sanctions-related, relief-related talks between the U.S. and Iran, why this move and why now?
Well, there are lots of speculations about that, Danny, and this was something that did not come as a surprise to all of those who were observing the recent developments in the past couple of months. We are dealing with a team in the White House, which basically comes from a business background rather than a diplomatic background, if you will. So in this time around, unlike the JCPOA, the Iranian negotiating team is negotiating with the business people. And by that I mean the tactics that are used in these negotiations are very different than the ones that were applied during the JCPOA negotiations. So you see some of those traditional techniques that U.S. businessmen usually apply, like playing hard to get the best deal that you can, pretending to walk away from the table. These are the things that we're seeing quite happening quite often in this round of talks. So once again, if our viewers are wondering why snapback now, this could all be part of the U.S. and its EU allies playing the good cop, bad cop game, maybe, to try to lure Iran into what they want Iran to accept.
Thank you, Gisu and Batul Sobeti. Welcome to our conversation, and thank you for your patience. Now, Batul, chief of Iran's nuclear agency, Mohammad Islami, said this, quote, anti-Iran resolution is strictly aimed at pressuring Iran into giving concessions, and earlier had said that it was a part of political manipulation and lies, as he said a couple days ago when the Troika put out the proposing the resolution. Your initial thoughts, please.
Absolutely. I fully agree with the statement put by the Iranian spokesperson. The matter is not a technical one. It is a political one. In fact, as the report was mentioning, Iran's intelligence files have shown that the Israeli occupation entity has been cooperating very closely with the IAEA. So this is the Western political direction looking out for the interests of Israel, ultimately to make Iran look bad, because they have not caught Iran going against the agreement in any way. And they have absolutely no proof that Iran has used nuclear energy for non-peaceful means. So it's obvious that the nuclear file here has been used historically as a political pressure lever. Here we see the American pressure meeting with the European pressure. They are collaborating ahead of those negotiations this weekend, also, as the other speaker mentioned, to maximize the pressure on the negotiations to get the maximum concessions out of them. We know the reality of the nuclear file was never about, per se, just even curbing Iran's level of enrichment, because America historically has a track record of including other non-related aspects to what is supposed to be a nuclear file, like discussing the ballistic missiles or Iran's support for regional resistance. So all of this really indicates to us that the politics of power is currently walking in the world. The world order is built on oppression and transgression, because even the terms and the institutions that the West itself creates, like the IAEA, like the UN, they create these institutions to secure their own interests. When it comes to Iran specifically, the IAEA is the transgressor, because it has no proof against Iran for it to be accusing it in such a way. Such an institution not only has no credibility, but I believe it's actually a threat on all other countries, as it's demonstrated that it will act in the interests of the superpower and the hegemony that they want to pass. This proves that this is a world order that is unjust, and it is therefore unsustainable. And for that reason, we're seeing these rising powers like Russia, like China, like Iran, reject the status quo and look for alternatives.
And Batul, I'm glad you mentioned the IAEA's credibility here, because in a joint statement earlier, Iranian officials, including the Foreign Ministry and the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, said that Western countries continue to undermine the IAEA's credibility for their own political purposes. Gisu, it seems they want more than just compliance from Tehran. They want total obedience and for Tehran to get nothing back as far as concessions go.
Well, it depends what side you're talking about. If it's the U.S., well, yes, that's the ideal situation that the U.S. would want. But as far as the IAEA is concerned, the NPT is a very clear an international convention. It's an international treaty that countries have signed and have been complying with. Iran has been one of the first countries to sign the NPT, and as a signatory to the NPT, it has had and enjoyed, of course, the inalienable right to acquire nuclear technology for peaceful purposes, and this happened before the Islamic Revolution, part of the Atoms for Peace project of Eisenhower. So as far as Iran's nuclear program is concerned, the IAEA has constantly been monitoring Iran. Iran has been one of the most cooperative countries with the IAEA when it comes to supervision from the International Atomic Energy Agency. And this is, of course, according to the IAEA supervisors themselves. They've had always access to all of Iran's nuclear facilities. Just a quick reminder, 2 months ago, Rafael Grossi, the director general, visited Iran upon his own request, meaning that he called Iranian officials and said that he wanted to come to Iran and visit, and he was granted that visit. Even here at Press TV, we had the opportunity to talk to him exclusively, and he mentioned that he was quite impressed with the level of advancement of Iran as far as the peaceful applications of nuclear technology are. He visited an exhibition of those achievements, actually particularly radiopharmaceuticals and different applications of nuclear technology and agriculture and industries and, of course, to produce energy. Let's not forget that climate change is also a very big issue right now, and clean energy is something that all of the countries are now seeking. Let's not forget that even Saudi Arabia is now thinking of having its own nuclear power plants.
And, when you listen to the list, Batul, that Gisu just names off, you would think that Iran should be treated as a role model, a model for achieving a civilian nuclear program and having it advance with all the challenges it's had to this point. And, instead of being celebrated, it is being condemned by the West.
Absolutely. Iran has walked with the laws fully, and the extent of the inspections that are imposed on Iran, it does not exist anywhere else in the world. Iran is compliant. The rest are not compliant, including the IAEA itself. And this opens the door for Iran to take extra measures to stop this nonsense. But we know in reality that all of this has to do with Iran being an independent nation and not towing the line of America and wanting to maintain the integrity of its sovereignty. Iran, I would argue, is the only country in the world has a government that is not coerced by America. And this leaves Iran as actually a role model and an example for rejecting hegemony for the rest of the global nations. No other country says no to American interests at the expense of its own nation. And this leaves it as an example for a new world order built on mutual respect. They are pressurizing Iran so that it gets out of this situation, and so it ultimately bows down to America. This is the whole crux of the issue with Iran. It's not even the nuclear files are simply a gateway for the West to pressure Iran to get it to bow down to it, rather than being concerned about its nuclear file. Otherwise, if we look just back in history, during the 60s, it was under Western auspices that they allowed Iran to enrich under the Shah. We know that the West turns a blind eye against the Islamic nuclear Pakistan, for example. So this, in actual fact, the crux of the issue is not even nuclear. It's about wanting Iran to bow down. But Iran won't bow down, even if it has to go out of the phase of strategic patience. Iran will never forego its rights. But Iran also tries to stop escalations to the maximum that it can.
And Batul, I want to stay with you for a second because Gisu already spoke on this. So when I ask you to help us from your perspective understand the political motivations here behind this resolution, because even in a joint statement, all these parties involved, they reaffirmed Iran's consistent cooperation with the IAEA. You're saying this entire process is what, geared toward full submission to U.S. dictates. Do you see anything, other machinations involved other than that political objective?
They're using it as ultimately as part of the trap of diplomacy. The IAEA has nothing to do with Iran's relations with the West politically. Its job is technical. But when it becomes a tool of political pressure, Iran is very aware of this, and Iran won't be dragged to these false allegations, nor would Iran ever turn the nuclear file into another issue, which is also something that the West has historically done by bringing other subjects like the ballistic missiles. What has been proven is that the IAEA acts on behalf of Western political interests. After this, it's become so clear that Iran, in my opinion, should even refuse dealing with Grossi and should stipulate dealing with someone else, especially after it's been clear that not only is there a hypocrisy and a double standard surrounding their silence of the Israeli occupation entity and its nuclear warheads, but they are in agreement with this entity based on that intelligence dossier, that Iran, it's actually been relying on the wishes of the entity that is not within the non-proliferation treaty, that is not following any laws, that is secret about its nuclear warheads. The whole subject of the matter is a control of Western interests over here through also preserving the Israeli occupation entity's interests. So we know that many things that Israel wants against Iran that has nothing to do with the nuclear file are being brought up in these negotiations. And so these negotiations become about attacking Iran as a whole. Its objective is to limit Iran's power. Otherwise, as I mentioned, entities like Pakistan and India in the region have nuclear weapons, but they don't even care. This is all about curbing Iran's power and potential, because Iran itself has said, if it's about the nuclear weapons, we don't want nuclear weapons. Sayyid Ali Khamenei has that famous fatwa of not producing nuclear weapons, but it's not about that, ultimately. It's about curbing Iran's power to be self-sufficient.
Thank you, Batul. And Gisu, you earlier mentioned Iran as one of the original NPT signatories, which brings us to someone in the region who is not an entity that is not, obviously, and it'd be also a huge injustice to our story, not to mention the Israeli, here's a racist, genocidal entity on stolen land with undisclosed nuclear stockpile, obviously zero oversight, not a signatory to the NPT, but beside that, they are allowed to manipulate the IAEA and weaponize it against the Islamic Republic and Rafael Grossi, for that matter. The Europeans and the U.S. seem to have no problem with this. Please help this one, Gisu, make sense.
Exactly. That is one of the big question marks that is hanging over the IAEA and the NPT as a whole, that a regime that has proven in practice to be a threat to peace in the region. It is currently running a genocidal war in Gaza. It has been going on for almost 2 years, and also attacking its neighboring countries. Let's not forget the attacks on Beirut, the capital of Lebanon, and southern Lebanon. It has been occupying Syrian land for decades now, the Golan Heights. And of course, all of these actions are seemingly unnoticed by its staunch ally, the United States, and of course other Western countries mostly, and other European countries in particular, that give the Israeli regime their full support, turning a blind eye to what this regime is capable of, considering the number of nuclear warheads that it has. And now, let's not forget that the covert operation carried out by the Iranian intelligence also clearly has revealed that Rafael Grossi and the IAEA has turned into a tool, a political tool, in the hands of these countries, including the Israeli regime.
And Batul, you want to weigh in on that? Here's a regime that explicitly laughs at UN resolutions, UN institutions, including the IAEA, but somehow the International Atomic Energy Agency allows itself to be manipulated by this very entity.
Of course, because the IAEA is not independent or impartial. It represents the political direction and tells the American line. It has no integrity since the Western countries themselves, Europe, simply follows America. There's no sovereignty in this regard. So an entity like the IAEA's credibility is very low. Within agreements present, there are transgressions against countries that founded these very institutions and devised these very laws. So this kind of intervention that we're seeing is based on political interests. And for that reason, you see that the Israeli occupation entity has warheads that are undisclosed, and it's not even a part of the NPT. It doesn't even subscribe to international law in any way, shape or form. Yet it is the political dictates over here that are stopping a peaceful program like the Islamic Republic of Iran has, because ultimately the issue was never about nuclear weapons or Iran possessing nuclear weapons. It's about an Iran that is independent. It is about Iran that is sovereign, having any right to its own program, having any rights to its own self-sufficiency and national sovereignty. So this shows us that the IAEA doesn't want to walk with the actual terms that it has set for itself due to the political interests and direction of the West to which it is captive. So it's not surprising at all that they would work closely with the Israeli occupation entity.
And Gisu, Iran has always shown that it's very flexible, especially when it comes to its nuclear program, to allay concerns, especially from the West. It will engage in relevant diplomatic exchanges and discussions if they are balanced, if they are not hostile, if they don't involve coercion and threats. Why is it that the West is always choosing that other option when Iran has always shown the strong will for equal terms in diplomacy?
Well, first of all, they do not consider Iran as an equal partner, and that is very clear. Well, these are all colonial powers of the 19th century, and now clearly they don't believe that countries in the Middle East should be treated as equals. They have the mentality that these countries should still be subservient and of course complying with everything that those countries which are now considered as world powers dictate them, and that is clearly the way they treat Iran. And Iran as an independent country has proven over the past 46 years that it will no longer bow down to any kind of bullying or other games that these world powers would want to play.
And Batul, we barely have enough time left. I should really be signing off, but I really want to get that same question to you. When you think what the U.S. is doing with this maximum pressure in sanctions, the constant threats by itself and its ally in Israel of military attacks, threats of new sanctions to come, demanding Iran achieve zero uranium enrichment, And now with the IAEA and the Europeans joining this facade, it seems like there could be a much better and more prudent approach. The Islamic Republic has always welcomed a more equal footing and equal approach.
Of course, and I think inevitably, sooner rather than later, America will have to realize that if it wants to preserve its own interests, it has to deal with the real and the active forces on the ground, because four decades of besieging, sanctioning Iran, and all kinds of the worst machinations, from assassination campaigns on its nuclear scientists to smear campaigns to literally the eight-year war in Iran, all of it was designed to crush the very spirit and the cornerstone of the revolution, which calls for independence, self-sufficiency, sovereignty, supporting the rights of all oppressed, maintaining an open hand policy towards the oppressed that want to free themselves from that same hegemonic power, which is the United States of America. That is the whole crux and the contention with Iran. But ultimately, all of these threats have not made Iran yield. We see Iran is not backing down. Its strategic patience has practically reached the max. And Iran will do what it needs to do to preserve its own interests.
All right, thank you both for joining us on the program, Batul and Gisu. Stay safe to both of you. Batul Sobeti, their activist and political analyst, joining us from London, and Gisu Misha Ahmadi, our senior correspondent here at Press TV, joining us in our Tehran studios. Thank you. And this brings us to the conclusion of this segment of your Spotlight program. Thank you for tuning in, and bye-bye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast round the clock for listeners across the globe. The English channel of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting can be heard via shortwave, internet, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,710 kilohertz every day on 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in the Southern Africa can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 11,740 kilohertz every day on 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Iran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the English channel of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. You can also listen to the radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means.
Thank you.
Speaker, the Prime Minister of the State of Israel.
These are glimpses of the moments of Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of the Israeli regime, speaking at the U.S. Congress. He is welcomed by members of the U.S. Congress as if he were a hero returning from the battlefield. This is only part of the deep and strategic bond between the United States and Israel in regional and international relations.
For the forces of civilization to triumph, America and Israel must stand together. I thank President Biden for his heartfelt support for Israel after the savage attack on October 7th. He rightly called Hamas sheer evil. He dispatched two aircraft carriers to the Middle East to deter a wider war. And he came to Israel to stand with us during our darkest hour, a visit that will never be forgotten.
Ever since the formation of Israel, Western superpowers have viewed the regime as a reliable ally that can guarantee their interests without the need for direct military presence. In the Suez Canal War of 1956, the Zionist regime, along with two old colonial powers, France and Britain, invaded Egyptian territory. The Suez Canal War, which began with a simultaneous invasion of Egyptian territory by the regime and the two European countries, ended with a major political victory for Gamal Abdel Nasser and his country after the Soviet Union threatened Paris and London with nuclear weapons, and the absolute indifference of the United States and lack of support for its allies against the Eastern Bloc. This was the beginning of significant changes in the power polarization in the New World. The The second phase of Israel's life was accompanied by French efforts to equip the regime's army with advanced weapons and significant technical assistance in developing its nuclear weapons program. However, the Six-Day War in 1967 and the preemptive attack by the Israeli regime on Egyptian, Syrian, Jordanian, and Iraqi territories, and the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip damaged political relations between Tel Aviv and Paris, and the French imposed an arms embargo on Israel. The third phase of the Israeli regime began with the French arms embargo and the entry of the main actor into the field, which continues to this day. The pinnacle of U.S. support and its decisive role in the Arab-Israeli wars and the change of the political course of the Middle East for the next 50 years was realized in the Yom Kippur War in 1973. During an operation called Nickel Grass, the United States established a massive air bridge to supply Israel with more than 22,000 tons of necessary weapons. With the delivery of a large amount of advanced American weapons and their deployment on the battlefield, the tide turned and Israel was saved from certain defeat in the Yom Kippur War.
It's a tiny little country that's acting as if it has some sort of moral right to impose its will on the world, dictating to the United Nations that gave it life, dictating to the Palestinians, dictating to the Lebanese, and now dictating to America.
Given the long history of Zionists in occupation and crimes against Arab and Muslim nations of the region, they had a difficult responsibility in reducing tensions with Arab countries and consequently reducing the number of their enemies. Without the direct presence of the United States to improve Israel's relations with some countries in the region, this seemed impossible. Through Washington's efforts, countries like Jordan and Egypt recognized Israel, and Persian Gulf states like Saudi Arabia completely abandoned the path of defending the Palestinian cause. With the signing of the so-called Abraham Accords, three other Arab countries, namely the UAE, Bahrain, and Morocco, officially began their relations with Israel, demonstrating the peak of U.S. political support for its regional gendarmerie, Israel. The Americans use Israel as a reliable executor to secure their strategic, political, and security interests in the Middle East, and fully support their countless crimes against the oppressed nations of the region. War and occupation to prevent the formation of an independent Palestinian state, war and efforts to destabilize Lebanon, conspiracies and direct attacks against Syrian territory and its legitimate government, and most importantly, direct confrontation with the resistance axis led by Iran have been the most important demands of the U.S. from the Israeli regime in recent decades.
When I talk about the events after October 7th, that the United States is pinned down in the Middle East because the United States is joined at the hip with Israel. It's very important to understand that the United States has a relationship with Israel that has no parallel in recorded history. The United States supports Israel unconditionally, and that's especially true when it comes to the Palestinian issue. The United States and Israel are more than just normal allies. The United States, again, supports Israel no matter what.
Whenever relatively independent countries in the United Nations and the Security Council take action to issue resolutions and condemn Israel's crimes in the region, they are immediately thwarted by the veto power of the U.S. or other Western countries supporting Israel. As a result, their efforts remain unsuccessful, and for many years, Israelis have enjoyed complete political immunity in international communities thanks to the overt support of the West.
You can clearly say is that American diplomacy, American policy in the region has been utterly feckless and counterproductive. It has deprived us of all of the rather large influence that we had accumulated in previous decades.
However, for Israel to succeed in its political designs from the perspective of the United States and the West, and to secure their interests, it needed military support and the construction of an army entirely based on American weapons. Since the formation of Israel in the 1940s, at least $310 billion in financial and military aid has been granted to them by Washington, which is considered the highest amount paid among America's allies worldwide.
The great advantage that the Israelis have is that they're joined at the hip with us. The Israelis could never do what they're doing in Gaza and in Lebanon without American support. These are American aircraft, American bombs. We give them huge amounts of money. We protect them diplomatically.
By looking at the Israeli army, we can clearly see that the air force of the regime consists of American fighter jets, weapons, refueling aircraft, transport planes, and AWACS. As soon as famous fighters such as the F-4, the F-16, the F-15, and F-35 entered service in the U.S. military, became immediate options for dispatch to the Israeli regime, and a large part of the purchase price for the weapons was usually provided as grants to the Zionists.
What's happening right now is Western credibility is being destroyed, and the West doesn't even recognize it, doesn't even care.
However, one of the most important pillars of Israel's defense is its missile system. Since the 1990s, when Iran's missile program saw significant development and the production rate of various ballistic missiles, such as the Shahab missile family, increased, the Israelis, who had previously experienced the bitter taste of confronting Scud missiles fired from Iraq during the Kuwait War, began designing an integrated missile system with the help of the United States.
The United States has lost all credibility, not just in the region, but in the world. We have been shown to be impotent. Netanyahu treats us with contempt. So far, he's entirely justified in doing so. We call for peace, and we do nothing to establish it.
Israel's missile system is composed of three layers based on the type of threats. The Iron Dome system is for countering short-range threats like artillery rockets. The David Sling and Arrow 2 systems are for countering tactical ballistic missiles in their terminal phase before impact, and the Arrow 3 system is for countering ballistic missiles outside the atmosphere. Although the Israelis claim to produce these systems domestically, a significant portion of the production lines, components, technology, and even the workforce come from the Americans. David Sling system, which entered service in 2017 as a replacement for the older Hawk and Patriot systems and is registered under the Israeli arms company Rafael, is actually the output of the famous American arms company Raytheon. Raytheon's production lines in 30 different states in the U.S. are engaged in producing parts and sending them to Israel for final assembly. The Iron Dome system, which has gained significant fame during conflicts with resistance access in Gaza and southern Lebanon in recent years, also has about 75% of its components, including Tamir interceptor missiles, produced in Raytheon facilities in Arizona, the United States, and is sent to Israel as pre-prepared parts. The Israeli companies Rafael and IAI are responsible for the final assembly of the system.
For the foreseeable future, we're going to support Israel no matter what. But again, you have to ask yourself, is that good for Israel? And we have not talked about what's happening inside Israel. What is the state of Israel today? But Israel is a country that is in deep trouble.
However, Israel's main hope for defense against Iranian missile attacks lies with the Arrow missile family. Between 1989 and 2007, more than $2.4 billion was injected into the Arrow missile defense project, with 80% of this amount funded by the United States. The Arrow 2 missiles entered mass production to defend the occupied territories against Iranian ballistic missiles. But with the progress of Iran's missile program, the Zionists sought a longer-range version of the Arrow missiles to counter Iranian missiles outside the atmosphere. Since 2008, as part of the joint missile program with Israel, the U.S. has allocated an average of $90 million annually to the development and production project of the Arrow 3 system.
We are just doing nothing but more funneling in more cash, another $8.7 billion. And that's on top of, I don't remember the number off the top of my head, I think it was $14 billion or something that we had previously given Israel to, on top of the $3.8 billion that we give them every year to fight the war that they, the pointless operation in the Gaza Strip, which also doesn't have a military solution. And they're, instead of even trying to bring that one to an end, we have been pleading, at least publicly, for a ceasefire so that we can find a negotiated settlement. But now then we see revealed in Politico a couple of days ago that actually that's just a bunch of nonsense. That's just words, because behind the scenes in the administration, we've been telling Israel, yeah, go ahead, continue on, go into Lebanon even, go against Hezbollah on the ground, launch another invasion here. Don't worry about a ceasefire. Certainly don't worry about a negotiated settlement. Just keep on going militarily. So we claim that, and then simultaneous with that, we send in a second aircraft carrier strike group into the area.
Part of the tests for this system, including the 2019 tests, were conducted in Alaska, the U.S. Stark Company, a branch of Israel Aerospace Industries located in the United States in Columbus, Mississippi, is responsible for producing the tubes for the Arrow 3 missile system. Overall, about half the components of the defense system are manufactured in the United States.
Iran does not want a wider war. It does not want a war with the United States. It does not want a war with Israel. And yet Netanyahu seems to be hell-bent on getting his region-wide war.
On April 1st, 2024, Israel carried out a terrorist and malicious act by targeting the Iranian consulate building in Damascus, resulting in the martyrdom of top Iranian commander General Zahedi and several of his companions. In the late hours of April 14, 2024, the Aerospace Force of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps launched Operation True Promise 1 with the code O Messenger of Allah, targeting the Nevatim and Ramon air bases, which were used as the main bases for this regime's strikes against the Palestinian people and attacks on Syrian territory. Operation True Promise 1 was an impressive display of part of the missile and drone capabilities of the IRGC, and a final warning to Israel if they continued their crimes, they'll face a heavier response and more surprising operations. Despite the readiness of the regime's various defense systems, many Iranian missiles managed to bypass the Zionist regime's air defenses and hit the Nevatim and Ramon air bases.
It is Israeli policy not to allow any reporting on the battle damage they have suffered. We don't know what the results of the Iranian reprisal were, and that makes it very difficult to understand what is happening. Here's some pictures of apparent damage to that base in the Negev. I think the Iranian missiles apparently are quite accurate, and this shows that.
Meanwhile, several other countries led by the U.S. were responsible for defending Israel and countering the projectiles fired from Iran. Dozens of fighter jets, AWACS, and refueling aircraft belonging to the United States, Britain, France, and Jordan flew over the region to counter Iranian cruise missiles and suicide drones. Western aircraft for bases such as Incirlik in Turkey, Al Udeid in Qatar, Al Dhafra in the United Arab Emirates, and Muwafiq Salti in Jordan patrolled the skies for long hours to counter the Iranian attack, and the U.S. Army radar systems in the region were responsible for detecting projectiles and assisting Israel's anti-missile system to increase their chances of successful interception. Additionally, the U.S. Navy destroyer in the Mediterranean Sea also assisted Israel's air defenses with their interceptor missiles, and without such extensive support for Israel, the number of projectiles hitting the occupied territories and the extent of the damage caused to the Israelis would have been much greater.
They were heavily dependent on the United States back in April to deal with the Iranian attack, and they're going to be heavily dependent on the United States if the Iranians attack again. Even if you look at what they're doing in Lebanon, they depend heavily on the United States. I believe we're giving them lots of intelligence and so forth and so on.
After the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran and the martyrdom of Sayed Hassan Nasrallah and Commander Abbas Nilfurushan in Israel's bombing of the Dahiya district of Beirut, the IRGC prepared for a larger operation and a more powerful strike against Israel. Five targets were selected by the commanders for Iran's retaliatory operation: the Nevatim Air Base, the largest air base in Israel's Negev Desert, and the main location for the Israeli Air Force's refueling fleet and F-35 stealth fighters. Tel Nof Air Base near Tel Aviv, one of the main centers for long-range F-15 fighter bombers. Hatzarim Airport, the departure point for the Israeli fighters in the assassination operation of martyr Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, the Netzarim crossing in the center of the Gaza Strip, where the armored equipment of the Zionist entity's army gathered for the attack on the oppressed people of Gaza, and finally, the headquarters of the Mossad intelligence organization in Tel Aviv. In Operation True Promise 2, this time, Iranian ballistic missiles were launched right at the beginning and reached the skies of occupied territories in less than 10 minutes, giving Israel's missile defense system much less reaction time and a more challenging task.
Khomeini. Aquí Teherán, la voz de la República Islámica de Irán.
Estimados oyentes, ahora escucharán las aleyas 9 a 11 de la sura de Hud del Sagrado Corán recitadas por el señor Vaghefi.
ولئن أذقنا الإنسان منا رحمة ثم نزعناها منه